Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
It's hard to know how to feel about an empty nest. Parents sometimes worry that their homes and their lives will never be full in quite the same way as when they had kids under their roof. Teenagers eager for independence fantasize about leaving, only to realize running one's own life isn't as easy as they'd assumed. In any case, it's a time of discovery for all involved. And in novelist Tom Perata's world of suburban banality spiced with sexual experimentation, the parting of a single mother and her only son is an opportunity to explore what this change looks like in a world of changing mores, instant messages, and a wide variety of internet pornography. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Tom Perata's previous novels include Little Children, Election, and The Leftovers. In his new book, Mrs. Fletcher, he introduces us to Eve Fletcher and her son Brendan on the day she drops Brendan, hungover from a wild night with his high school friends, off at his freshman dorm. That first semester does not go as either of them had planned, and the things they learn through trial and plenty of error go far beyond Brendan's university classes or the gender and society course Eve signs up for at the local community college as a way to fill her newly free evenings. Tom Perata joins us to talk about it all from the studios of NPR in New York City. Tom, welcome to Think.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So first I read the book, and then I read things that people had said about the book, and it seems lots of people are noting all the sex and the influence of the pornography and the many transitions reflected in the story. At its heart, to me, this felt like a book about what we do with loneliness.
Oh, well, that's a really interesting way to look at it. And, you know, I did start with the idea of a woman who, her job is done, her job of being a mom, and she's left with her own life and her own self. And in Eve's case, the nest really is empty. It's just her there. And, you know, the story is really how she does deal with that loneliness. And I think one of the important things that the book really gets at is when people are lonely now, they don't first turn to other people. They turn to the internet, or they turn to their phones, and they turn to apps. You know, I do think loneliness is different now than it used to be.
Yeah, initially she's like, I'll just fill up my nights watching a lot of Netflix.
Well, I've been there.
She's not someone who's in the habit of rocking the boat. So even when her son really disappoints her, on the day he's ready to leave, she has all these plans for they're going to have this heart-to-heart talk. She chooses not to say anything, and so she ends up kind of having to live with that after he leaves, and then is not so great about calling her very often.
Yeah, well, she has a real emotional agenda for that day when her son leaves for school. She wants it to be a memory of a sweet parting and a kind of ending to this chapter of their lives that has meant so much to her, and she hopes to him. And instead, he kind of ruins the day for her. He's not very helpful. He's not very respectful. And she catches him, you know, having a sexual encounter. She hears him through the door, and he is saying things to his girlfriend that kind of horrify Eve. And she knows that a good mother would have a talk with him on the way to college about respect and the right way to talk to women and the right way to think about sex. And she just can't do it because she knows it's going to create a conflict that's going to spoil her idea of what the day should be. So yeah, the book begins with a kind of parenting failure that I think is very common, at least to people that I know. I mean, I think we want to be friends with our kids, and we have a little trouble sometimes maybe taking on the parental role that our parents, maybe, you know, certainly my parents were more comfortable in.
I began this book really not caring for Brendan, but I will say I knew a lot of guys like that in college, right? Kind of entitled, he's this jock who's used to getting what he wants. And you have the sense that maybe he'll grow up and be a decent human being, but he's not there yet.
Yeah, well, I think those guys are pretty common in college, and I think they must be problematic for their mothers, you know, especially if their mothers are like Eve and think of themselves as feminist and progressive and have tried to raise them according to those values. And these guys go through puberty and they maybe get quiet and sullen and also get maybe treated a little too well in high school. And I think there's a kind of, you know, that feeling you have of not liking Brandon is a feeling I totally understand, but we also see it through Eve's eyes. She wants him to be a good person. She doesn't want him to be someone she worries about, someone she thinks might do some bad and disrespectful things. So that, you know, his unlikableness is a challenge to her. And I do think as the book goes on, he grows in maybe some incremental ways, or at least has his bubble of male privilege burst, and he's a more vulnerable character toward the end of the book than he is at the beginning, for sure.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's confronted with the reality that what he took for granted doesn't necessarily work in this new environment. For one thing, he finds himself surrounded by strong women who are not going to put up with his nonsense.
Yeah, and to his credit, he doesn't write them off, and he doesn't go off in search of weak women. So, you know, maybe that is how Eve's influence does make itself known in his life in some subtle way, that he does respect strong women, and he does feel the challenge that they pose to him. It can be a little excruciating to watch him try and think his way through some of the dilemmas that arise in his life, but that's, in that sense, he really is having the college experience his mother hoped, which is maybe he'll grow, maybe he'll meet people who will challenge him. At first, she fears for that because his roommate seems to be someone who could have been his teammate or his cousin, is a guy just like him, and that wasn't what Eve was hoping for.
I really loved the relationship between Brendan and his roommate because, yeah, initially we see, oh, he's got this guy and they're calling each other bro right away, and you sort of think that you know what's ahead for them. And then they have kind of a parting, and it made me think a lot about the way youthful friendships sometimes dissolve because we all mature at different rates. People are, you know, we look back on childhood or adolescence and we're baffled by why we didn't stay close to someone. And sometimes it's simply that someone has kind of an awakening earlier than someone else and they're not on the same plane anymore.
Yeah, and I think in a way, Brendan becomes a scapegoat. So Zach, his roommate, is a guy just like him, but Zach meets a woman, and I won't spoil it because it's something that unfolds over the course of the book, but who sort of challenges his ideas about who he would be attracted to and what it would mean. And he and Brendan are used to talking about girls in this really kind of sexist, bro-ish way. And Brendan is in the dark about what's going on in Zach's life and what he's grappling with in terms of being attracted to someone he never thought he would be attracted to. And when Zach parts with him, it's almost like he's trying to part with the part of himself that he needs to get rid of. Hmm. And Brendan has to stand in for that part. And I think he didn't do anything, well, he did do a lot of things wrong, but he did them wrong unwittingly. He didn't know why Zach was doing what he was doing and why he got left behind.
Well, what you do with the story is really interesting because I think there have been a lot of explorations in literature about the pressures on young women to conform to society's expectations. We don't necessarily look at the way that young men are shaped in the same way by what they think other people want of them. And it seems in the beginning that Zach and Brendan are really just in some ways performing what they assume is expected of privileged young white men.
Well, that's a really interesting way to talk about it, because I think the book is very much about identity, and it's about the way in which the labels we put on ourselves create the spectrum of behavior that we can take part in. And so, I think that's a really good way to put it. Brendan isn't somebody who would even think about gender or think about what it means to be a man. He's very certain about these things because the ideas that he has are very flattering to him. And it's not until other people start raising questions about who he thinks he is and what he thinks he can get away with that he has to deal with that. Whereas there are other characters, Eve included, who aren't that comfortable in the cards that have been dealt to them. And of course, they're the ones who are searching for a better label to put on themselves and new possibilities in their lives.
So Eve takes this community college class in gender and society, and it gives you a really interesting lens around which to form this story. And you populate the class with Eve and her professor, who happens to be a transgender woman, and a number of people who really wanted to take this class because of what it was, and others who had a credit that they had to fill and ended up sort of filtered in there. So you've got a really disparate group of people coming together to consider these different ideas.
Yeah, and it's... this class is sort of what Eve was hoping Brendan would get when he got to college, because it's a really interesting, diverse group of people. It's a professor who has had a very unusual and illuminating life experience, and she makes friends, and she goes out and gets drunk with these people, and it just has her mind opened. And whereas Brendan is doing all that he can to sort of deflect anything interesting in his classes. His mind is just, he's just a very self-centered guy who isn't interested in having his mind open. But yeah, this class is, in a way, Eve's idealized version of college. And it, I was very closely tracking, as I wrote, this moment in our culture when, what had been a very academic discussion of gender sort of burst into the mainstream, and all sorts of people who had not heard, this sort of way of thinking about gender and identity were suddenly exposed to it, and obviously created a lot of turmoil, but also a lot of people, rethinking their assumptions.
It's an interesting needle to thread as a comic novelist, because I think even 10 or 15 years ago, the comedy here might have come from the fact that Eve and her son and other people were like very uncomfortable meeting someone who was a transgender woman and meeting people whose, sexual identities weren't sort of the standard binary. You can't be that simplistic here, because this is 2017. So you have to really get more nuanced in exploring the way people respond to this.
Yeah, I know. I think, Eve in particular, I think, is standing in for a lot of people who were meeting or thinking about transgender people seriously for the first time. And she kind of knows that she has some reflexes that came from growing up in a time when, there were two genders and people had to pick one. And it was the one that they were born with. And so I think what I'm interested in more is the struggle that goes on in Eve's mind to see the full humanity of her professor. And I think, and become friend. And so I'm not at all interested in, there are a couple guys in the class who represent that kind of retro.
It's still out there for sure.
Yeah, it sure is. So, there are characters like that in the book, but they're there in the background. I think in the foreground is the students who really are challenged and intrigued by what their professor is telling them.
My guest is novelist Tom Perata. His earlier books include Election, The Leftovers, Little Children. His new novel is called Mrs. Fletcher. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter. We are @KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with novelist Tom Perata about his latest book, Mrs. Fletcher. It tells the story of a woman, Eve Fletcher, and her son, who is named Brendan, and leaving for college for the first time, both of their lives change in ways they can't have imagined at the beginning of the semester. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Tom, the professor here, Margot, is a really interesting character. She's happy and confident on one level, and insecure and a little lonely at the same time. Her transition to live as a woman, she knows it was the right decision, but it didn't solve every problem in her life.
Yeah, and one of the problems that it didn't solve is that she feels like part of being a woman is having this close bunch of women friends who, you know, she can gossip about. You know, she's sort of like, I watch too much Sex and the City and I read too many novels about these wonderful, intimate female friendships. And she's very open to Eve about that. I'm looking for girlfriends. And, it's somewhat surprising to Eve because, you know, they have this professional relationship and they haven't really socialized, but I think it's an interesting moment because the professor, who is a very smart and interesting woman, does sort of open up to Eve and make herself vulnerable. And Eve tries to be a friend to her and tries to rise to this unexpected occasion. And I think the book is a lot about people sort of taking the opportunity to expand their worlds, and I do, that was just a really interesting moment to see Eve, I think, understand what was being asked of her and finding a way to deliver. I think she does try to be a friend.
I was thinking about the work you had to do to kind of conceive of Margot's experiences and her challenges as a transgender woman. And then the more I thought about it, I realized that as a male author, you sort of step into that headspace in a certain way anytime that you write from the perspective of a character that is female. And I wonder if you thought about that consciously as you were figuring out who Margot was and what her experiences might be.
That's actually very interesting because I guess you could even say it might be easier for me to write a trans woman than
A woman.
They're
all women,
They're all women, right? And that was the other. I mean, you could look at it that way as well. You're right. Over the years, I've written a number of women characters, and it always feels like a challenge until. I think I work like an actor a little bit. I just try to connect with some part of that character that allows me to feel like, oh, I know this person and I share, this trait or this pattern of thinking with this character. And I think Margot sort of became clear to me when she started talking about her mother. My mother is wonderful, but I just suddenly understood Margot's. The mother just had no patience for her difficulties with gender, her sense that she was in the wrong body. And I could hear her voice and her complaints because her mother just did not want to engage with it. And she would just call it Margot's nonsense. And I think as Margot told this story about the way her mother tried to deflect and ignore her pain when she was a child.
Like even on her deathbed, she kept this up.
Even on, like somehow, a story like that just, it emerged from the scene and it was, I just have those moments when I write where I feel like, oh, I see this character now. I see what made her. More so than the backstory, say, that I had given her. It was just that moment when the character just starts speaking a truth that feels right to me. And that's that moment when those barriers just fall away. I feel like, oh, hear that, you know, this character speaking now.
You could really torture yourself, though, because so you can read about this or be conceiving it as a novelist, and you can extrapolate from your own, hopefully less existential struggles with your own parents. And then you have to think, oh, I'm a parent, too. And there's something that I'm doing or saying that I am not sort of fully understanding these people that I think I understand better than anyone.
Yeah, well, I think you can see that as a source of anxiety, or you could see it as something that's inevitable and that you can only hope your kid will forgive you for.
Right.
I think you try to avoid inflicting the pain that you know you're inflicting. It's hard to avoid inflicting the pain you don't know you're inflicting. So, that's certainly something that writing fiction has taught me, which is just... everybody has their blind spots, and everybody knows how to let themselves off the hook.
What are the challenges to writing about a character like Brendan, who does have some growth throughout this novel, but is not really an introspective character? So how do you get to what he's thinking when he's not, somebody like him is not spending a lot of time thinking about things?
That is a really good question, and I think the way that I answered it in the book is to have him uniquely in the novel deliver his sections in first person. Eve and everybody else that I write about comes in a kind of close third person, where you have sort of very clear intermittent access to their thought processes. And Brendan, you just have him kind of reacting to the world, and his limitations are, I think, very clear to the reader. But he also, because he's reacting, there's a kind of honesty in those reactions that I think allows the reader to, it's more like you just get a map of his mental universe rather than his reflections on it. When he does reflect, his reflections aren't that deep, but they do reveal what he won't let himself think about or isn't mature enough to think about yet. So that was an interesting question. And of course, the novel is very well suited for thoughtful, introspected, conflicted, complicated characters, and maybe not so suited for people like Brendan, who don't really have rich inner lives, and yet I think they need to be taken seriously as characters too. And Julian, who is another college kid, he's actually a classmate of Eve's and was a classmate of Brendan's, is a much more typical young teenage male character in a novel. He's sensitive, he's depressed, he's very thoughtful.
You can imagine Julian reading a novel, for instance.
You can imagine reading it, and you can imagine that he read Catcher in the Rye,
right,
and connected with it. Brendan is somebody you'd see maybe in a movie as a jerky frat guy, and nobody would actually care what he was thinking. They just want to see him get his comeuppance. I think it's an interesting challenge for a novelist to make a reader care about a guy that they wouldn't like in life and a character who they might write off as a jerk.
All right, I want to go to the phones now. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. My guest this hour is novelist Tom Perata. We're talking about his new book, Mrs. Fletcher. Let's speak with Greg in Houston. Hello, Greg.
Hi. My two questions were, Mr. Perata, what drew you to writing in the first place, and who were some of your literary influences?
Oh, hey, Greg. I think what drew me to writing probably is what draws everybody, which is I read a lot, and I'd loved I just had a very passionate reaction to the books I read from a very young age. And so it was in the same way that I loved music, and so I wanted to play the guitar. I loved books, so I wanted to write. I was a big fantasy and science fiction guy when I was in high school. I was big Tolkien reader. And then I had this one class, one AP English class, where we read a book called Nine Short Modern Novels, and it was Kafka and Camus and Joseph Conrad, just a bunch of great writers of the mid 20th century. And that I remember that book kind of blew my mind. And then later I kind of gravitated toward Raymond Carver and John Cheever and sort of the great American short story tradition.
This book feels in some ways like a sequel with different characters to Little Children. Same kind of community, but instead of parents sort of starting their lives as parents, this is about a mother who is completing her life, the most active part of her life as a parent.
Yeah, I do think in some ways I could look at Little Children, the abstinence teacher, and Mrs. Fletcher as a kind of trilogy about sex in the suburbs. And all about, the idea of sexual transgression in a certain way. In Little Children, there are two kinds of transgressions. There's an adulterous couple, and then there's this pedophile. And what the story ultimately says is the community can obviously include the adulterous couple. It can include the pedophile, and it's sort of, but it is, in the 19th century, the adulterous couple was the transgressors that had to be ostracized. In the abstinence teacher, Ruth is just a sex education teacher, but there are people who think that is transgressive. And in this one, Eve gets very interested in, she sort of stumbles into this amateur pornography that she's sort of appalled by on one level, but she's alone and kind of feeling a sexual need, and she just keeps returning to the well of this one amateur porn site that shows videos of middle-aged women who are sharing their sex lives with the world, and it kind of leads her to think of herself in a new way and to experiment sexually, and so... Yeah, I think all these novels are looking at people who are, crossing boundaries that have been placed around what's permissible in the sexual arena.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is novelist Tom Perrotta. We're talking about his new book, Mrs. Fletcher. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. So Eve finds herself realizing she's attracted to one of her employees, a young woman, and she has to figure out what to do with this. What's really interesting about this is that she doesn't come to a place where she thinks she has to redefine herself as lesbian or even bisexual. She just realizes maybe this kind of attraction is an option she just hadn't considered was available to her before.
Yeah, and I actually think that there's just no natural or inevitable way to think about sex. We all kind of figure out what people around us are doing and what is sort of within the spectrum of what's permissible sexually, and then we conduct ourselves accordingly. Once Eve starts watching this porn, a big category is this lesbian porn, and she gets very interested in it. And she notices that what she's watching always involves seduction, and it involves a very confident woman seducing a reluctant one. And she really finds herself completely engrossed in this process of seduction. And so when she goes out on what may or may not be a date with her coworker, she just starts realizing, oh, this is just like those seduction scenarios that I've watched. And as a result, I think something that if it happened 2 weeks before would have just seemed like a nice night out with a friend suddenly takes on this aura of erotic possibility. And, she starts to think, am I the confident one? Am I supposed to be seducing her, or is she supposed to be seducing me? There's a certain comedy to it, because it's, as you say, she's not going like, oh, I'm now attracted to women. It's more like, I am in an erotic situation, and I'm an erotic actor. And so do I actually take this step? And again, I won't spoil the scene, but it is, to me, it's more once she puts this label of MILF on herself, she starts to want to behave accordingly.
So I had to really examine my own biases here, because in this scene where Eve is with her coworker, you're kind of rooting for her because you know her heart's in the right place, and you wonder how this is going to turn out. And it occurred to me that if she, you know, if this were a man with a young woman and he made the moves on a young employee, I would have a really different feeling about his sort of moral responsibility not to do this sort of thing and take advantage of an underling, basically.
Right, right. Well, Eve is well aware of all the complexities of her behavior. I mean, one of the things...
She is. She frets about it up and down.
Up and down. And one of the things she notices, of course, you know, she is the executive director of the senior center. She is a very responsible, good boss. She knows that sexual harassment is a terrible thing. But in this porn she watches, there's no such thing as sexual harassment. Anytime a situation is set up, you know, here's a teacher and a student, here's a doctor and a patient, you know, here's a personal trainer and a client, whatever it is, in the world of porn, everybody just wants to have sex and they don't recognize any external boundaries. And so she's sort of caught between her real world role as a boss and this sort of fantasy in which all that is just window dressing and people really just want to take their clothes off and be together. So once it's over, of course, she's full of regret and a sense of bewilderment as to how she could have behaved in a way that so completely goes against everything she knows is right.
My guest is author Tom Perata. His earlier novels include The Leftovers, Election, and Little Children. We're talking today about his new novel, which is called Mrs. Fletcher. If you'd like to join our conversation, call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find us on Twitter. We are @KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with novelist Tom Perata about his new book, Mrs. Fletcher. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. This book really dances around an interesting paradox in American culture. On the one hand, there is a sort of cultural meme that when a woman has reached middle age, she's a mom, she is not sexy, right? Moms are practical and dull and whatever. On the other hand, the pressure that most women feel to continue to try to look attractive does not really fall away. And so it's a weirdly transgressive notion that anybody would be specifically attracted to women whose identity is centered around their status as parents. And you used the term earlier. We'll let people Google it if they don't know what it means. But can you talk a little bit about why that interested you for this book?
Well, so the book is about this moment of empty nest where, you know, you're relieved of your parental responsibilities. And so depending upon what age you were when you had kids, you know, you find yourself your early, mid, late 40s, you know, in at least among people I know, that doesn't feel old. That doesn't feel like you've retired from the sexual realm. And you know, for married couples, I think there's, you know, a sort of pressure to sort of reexamine the marriage and figure out, you know, what this next chapter is going to be. But for somebody like Eve, the loss of her son to college really does make her acutely aware of her own loneliness and her own desire to connect sexually and with somebody. And I think she's feeling a little morose at the beginning of the story because she doesn't really feel like she has a sexual identity. Dating hasn't gone well. There's nobody expressing any interest in her at the moment. And when this anonymous obscene text comes to her and uses, you know, sort of says, "You're the kind of woman I fantasize about," and she realizes through her explorations that this is a whole genre of porn dedicated to that. Instead of being horrified, which she thought she would be, she senses like, oh, somebody is thinking of me as an object of desire, and it's a kind of a rejuvenating experience for her. And she, you know, I don't think she wholeheartedly embraces this identity, but she tries it on. And she finds that when she does try it on, her life becomes a little more exciting, and she's aware of possibilities, you know, that she hadn't been aware of before, and that's exciting. And I think you can be so lonely that a mistake is better than nothing.
I like that, you know, a lot of what she's looking at online is like this amateur stuff, right? It's not professionally produced in a studio somewhere. It's made by regular people. And she's asking herself, it's like an anthropological study at first. She's like, who are these people that are willing to, you know, allow people to watch them in these intimate acts? And I guess ultimately, it's kind of like a pact, right? If someone were to recognize someone from one of those videos, they'd have to admit that they were watching those videos.
Yeah, and that there's that, and I think there's just it shocked me, you know, when I started really looking into this in writing the book. It just feels like, you know, it's like being in a train station or something. There just feels like there's just an unlimited number of strangers in the world who are doing this. I've certainly never come across somebody that I know. So you're just wondering, like, who are all these people? I mean, that's a whole other story, I guess, of what happens when you see somebody that you know. But for Eve, it almost says to her, maybe there's nothing to be ashamed of. You know, I mean, shame is, again, one of those things we all agree that something is shameful. And so, you know, a couple generations ago, being divorced was shameful. And somehow she's looking at all these other people who seem to have moved beyond some conventional notion of shame. And she says, you know, some of them, you can tell that they're just really proud of themselves. Like, this is the area of life in which I shine, and I want the world to see it, and I want the world to like it. You know, Eve never quite gets to that place herself, but she does inch away from the idea that there's something shameful about sharing your sexuality with the world.
So you talk about this a little bit specifically. You know, Eve comes back in contact with her ex-husband, Brendan's father, because of some things that happen. And we learn that over the years, she's gone from really despising him to thinking he's done a pretty good job with his new wife and they have a special needs child. And what I really liked about those descriptions is that it really adds so much depth to this character that we really only know for 3 or 4 months of her life. But we recognize that she's already done a significant amount of growing before she's arrived at this place where she's really making some changes.
Yeah, well, she's grown in the way that many of us have to grow, which is against her will. You know, her husband left her in a kind of cruel way. He went on Craigslist while they were still married and started having these casual encounters, and one of them turned serious, and so he left Eve and he left Brendan and you know, married this woman that he met on Craigslist named Bethany, and they had a child, and the child has autism, and she had that kind of very unflattering, it was a very selfish reaction at first, which was serves them right. They thought they were living some fantasy, and now they got a dose of reality. But what she then saw was that they rose to the occasion and they've become really wonderful, dedicated parents. And it's kind of deprived her of that feeling of superiority that, you know, helped her a little bit. And so she begrudgingly has to say, like, he's been really good about this. He is, you know, he has also grown. He's become a better man than he used to be. She still feels like, why couldn't he have been that good man for me? But it is, it's a very complicated reaction. And it, when it's first introduced, it really is more just another element of her frustration, which is she can't even hate her ex-husband.
Another complicated reaction that you described to us really nicely is the relationship that Margot, this is the transgender professor from Eve's Community College class, has with a student. And we should note this is an adult student. You know, it's community college, so he's, I guess, a military veteran. And he is a straight man, and he's really interested in Margot. And yet, there is part of him, as much as he really enjoys her company and is attracted to her, that worries about, like, what his buddies would think if they were to see them together. And he struggles with that. He feels bad about it, and yet it's still there for him.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when Eve and her friend Amanda are discussing Margot, Amanda tells a story about someone she knew in college who transitioned, a trans man. And Eve listens to it and says, you know, it's almost like a Cinderella story. You know, you give yourself a new name and you get a new life and you find everything that you wanted, because that was sort of the story that Amanda told. But I think, you know, Margot's story is not a Cinderella story. It's a really tough story of, you know, moving toward the life that you want, and you don't just get everything that you hoped for, but you get a truer life. And so Dumel, the man who is interested in Margot, he doesn't just, you know, fall in love with her and overcome, you know, all of the social barriers that exist, but we watch him sort of struggling to take a step forward. And to me, you know, that's always much more convincing and real than a sort of epiphany where somebody just changes on a spot. I think people grow slowly and you know, in strange bursts.
Yeah, and it seems like your characters often hold conflicting thoughts and ideas in their heads at the same time, and sometimes don't act on either one of them, but have them there informing, you know, the way they see their lives.
Yeah, and those are the interesting areas to write about for me. I think we're all just living in, you know, at least time seemed very confusing to me, and the world has changed so much in the time that I've been alive, and we're often struggling with ourselves as much as we're struggling with the people around us or our society.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is novelist Tom Perata. His latest book is called Mrs. Fletcher. You also wrote The Leftovers, which many people are aware became a very widely watched television miniseries. I guess it was a series over several seasons on HBO. That, you know, I really liked the novel and was looking forward to the series, and then I realized this is something, it's the novel was maybe a jumping off point, but you go in very different directions. So I wonder if you can talk about how you thought of the original product when you were involved with the creation of the series that would really have a different trajectory.
Yeah, well, you know, the show was a collaborative effort. I created it with Damon Lindelof, who is the man behind the show Lost. And he's a brilliant writer, and he comes at storytelling from a very different place than I do. He's much more comfortable with sci-fi and fantasy and genre writing of all sorts. And he really pushed. I had set some limits in the novel. I said, there's going to be this big event that's like the rapture, but it's not the rapture. People all over the world disappear at the same moment. And the story picks up 3 years later. And it's a purely realistic novel just about people grappling with what happened and the damage that they have is sort of internal. And Damon really pushed the show into kind of dark, mythic, surrealist territory. And it was so exciting for me to watch my work get transformed into well, I thought, you know, just a really amazing show that was something that I never would have been able to do on my own. And I just came to think about what happened, not so much as adaptation, but transformation. And now I really like that idea that the point of adapting isn't to just replicate the book in another medium, but to create a new kind of art.
It seems like it takes a lot of confidence for you as an artist to be comfortable with that, right? Not to say, I have written the one and only great version of this thing and for these characters and with this scenario.
Yeah, and I will say, you know, it was maybe a little harder for me the first season when we were dealing very explicitly with the book. Once we grew beyond the book, you know, I think we both felt a lot freer to do new things and expand on it. But I felt like it always felt like an additive process to me. In other words, we changed things, but it didn't diminish the book. It just added to it and added to it in a way that was very exciting. And it took me saying from the beginning, I'm not here to protect my book. I'm here to, you know, try and tell a good story in the form that we're working in.
What made you make the call to say, I'm not here to protect my book? Like, it seems like that would be everybody's instinct. And so many authors I've spoken to that have had their work translated into film, you know, almost inevitably, they're disappointed with what became of their original work.
Yeah, well, it's really helped that I've just had amazing luck. You know, my book Election was turned into, I think, just one of the funniest movies I've ever seen, and a movie that has really stuck in the public imagination. And then Todd Field and I co-wrote the script for Little Children, which I think is also an extraordinary movie. So I ended up feeling like, you know, if you work with really good people, you have to kind of let them do what they do, and you can't sort of, and I wanted to be part of it, and you can't be a collaborator if you're saying, you know, my choices need to be respected, or my choices need to be paramount. You know, so I just like to go into it saying I'm here to work with you and not to dictate.
So you had Little Children and The Abstinence Teacher. You have Mrs. Fletcher. Can you imagine yourself in a decade or two writing about the sex lives of people approaching retirement?
Well, I hear they're pretty wild. that's what I read. I do seem to be following the course of my own life, and certainly Mrs. Fletcher has some scenes set in the senior center, but we don't get to know the older people the way we know some of the other characters. So I think so. I mean, in this case, I'll take Philip Roth as a model. I think his late work dealing with aging, it was just extraordinary.
Tom Perata's new novel is called Mrs. Fletcher. He joined us today from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. Correction there. Tom, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you for making time for us.
Oh, thanks for having me. It was great to talk to you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening. Have a great day.